Thank you. Justice Fernandez-Mina is participating by phone. Justice Albin, did you have a question? I'm sorry I interrupted you earlier.
First, in my question to Mr. Codd, I wasn't suggesting that a business has to seek a formal opinion. It's just one tool. My question to you is, could Cremerlin have relied on just one of these informal investigative decisions and therefore have invoked a good faith defense? Forget about three. Would one have been enough, in your opinion?
I think, Justice Albin, it would depend which one and what it said. I think to the extent that the Department of Labor, through an authorized representative, said you are a trucking industry employer and therefore you should follow the trucking industry employer rules, and that's what our department has determined for you, I think one would be enough. It's easy to imagine a less formal communication that would not trigger the defense, but I don't think those are the facts that are before the court. And again, I would ask the court, when it renders its decision in this case, to think not only about Cremerlin. The facts of which this case look more like a law school hypo than any case I've ever seen before this court, but to think about the broader picture throughout New Jersey about how small businesses are supposed to take advantage of the good faith exception.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Jacobs.
Okay, Chief Justice, I just want to congratulate Justice Pierre-Louis on joining the finest Supreme Court in the country, and that's all I had.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindhorst.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The law is not supposed to be a gotcha, and the good faith defense is designed to prevent a gotcha. And when Cremerlin is told three times by the regulator with responsibility for enforcing the statute that it is a trucking industry employer and therefore may pay overtime a certain way, and it relies on those rulings and it is conceded that it did rely, the good faith defense does not permit a finding to say, gotcha, at the same time you were told all of those things by that regulator, you were not actually a trucking industry employer. Argument is made that these determinations do not fall within the good faith defense because they were not personally taken or issued by the commissioner or director as an individual, and that actions taken on their behalf do not count. We need only go one section over in the statute to 25.1, which indicates that an action may be commenced seeking wages going back currently 6 years, probably 2 years when this was filed. And we will determine an action is filed when it's filed with the commissioner or the director. Now, does anybody think that the commissioner or the director, him or herself, have to be sitting at the filing window in order for an action to be properly commenced? Otherwise, the statute of limitations continues to run? Of course not. That's not the modern way that agencies operate. And if the heads of those agencies had to personally exercise all of the powers and authorities vested in them, if the statute does not specifically say, or those acting on their behalf, it would significantly interrupt agency operations. Now, the suggestion has further been made that these were low-level, investigative, preliminary, informal. I'm quite confident that when the investigator appeared at Cremerlin, armed with all of the authorities under the statute to compel evidence, to compel sworn statements, and to assess penalties, and when it did, in fact, assess $40,000 in penalties, Cremerlin saw nothing informal about that. Now, it had the right to appeal, and it did appeal. And again, at a higher level, the hearing officer looked at the record, looked at the results of that full investigation, and made the very consequential determination that he would abate the penalties. Now, Cremerlin had no mechanism to take it further and no reason to take it further. And that's a very common decision-making hierarchy in government agencies. You have several levels. They can be taken to higher levels, but at whatever level it stops is the agency's action. And if it had stopped with the assessment of 40,000 in penalties, Cremerlin owes 40,000 in penalties. It stopped with a determination and a ruling, expressly on the grounds that Cremoland was a trucking industry employer. That was not a narrow determination. That was not a determination that John Doe was properly paid 1 hour of overtime in February. It was a construction of the term for a trucking industry employer. Cremoland was determined and was told it was determined by the regulator that it's a trucking industry employer on three occasions. And each of those things is more than enough for it to have relied, which it did rely, in good faith on that determination. And the statute under these circumstances provides it with a defense.
Questions, anyone? Anything else, Mr. Lindhorst?
Well, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Sadaraju.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justices, may it please the court. There are critically consequential issues on it before this court on this appeal. The wage and hour law, as interpreted by this court, has a salutary and remedial purpose, and this court should approach any question regarding the scope and application of it, mindful of the need to further its remedial purpose. It's the law is to be interpreted broadly with the idea, which was set forth in the Hargrove case, of casting a wide net for workers who fall under its protections. The appellants in this case want to strip away the statutory rights of a class of workers based on a handwritten note and a couple sentences by mid-level employees. There's no basis under this for the statute. In this case, all we've asked for is a plain reading of Section 56A.25.2, which is what the appellate division did here. And before I break down the statute, I address the specific statutes, I want to talk about one issue that was not appealed by appellants in this case, and that was a determination by the appellate division that discovery had not been completed. We did not have they moved for discovery 3 months before they moved for summary judgment 3 months before the end of discovery, before we had opportunities to depose people from Cremoland to investigate what their representations were and what facts that led them to argue that they were a trucking industry employer. There's very strong case law in the Raymore Flanagan case that just because you have a trucking function does not necessarily mean that you're a trucking industry employer. We didn't have that right because they moved for discovery before we deposed any of the people from Cremoland. That issue is not on appeal. So regardless of what happened, the determination here, this case should be remanded for us to complete our discovery on this important issue. Now, looking at the specific language of Section 56A.25.2, there's two sections which my colleagues have addressed. I'd like to address them as well. And I'd also like to talk about what the statute does not say. The statute does not say that in order for this safe harbor to this good faith defense to be invoked, there's no mention of hearing officers. There's no mention of investigators. There's no mention of that whatsoever. And yet defendants or the appellants want to come forward and say, well, we should read that into the statute when it's not there. And the policy arguments they're making about why it's important that we do that, that's an argument for the legislature to amend the statute to include determinations by hearing officers or by investigators. The statute doesn't say that. Section 1 specifically says the commissioner of the Department of Labor or the director of the Wage and Hour Bureau. Other parts of the statute make reference to saying or their designees or their representatives. This section doesn't say that. Because the legislature wants to cast a wide net, it doesn't want it to be easy for an employer to use to invoke this defense, because by virtue of invoking this defense, you're stripping people of their statutory rights. And so Section 1, it could not be more clear, as the appellate division set forward, that these are the two people by whose authority an employer is allowed to make a good faith defense based on their regulation order ruling approval or interpretation. That doesn't exist here. The second part, any administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department or bureau with respect to the class of employers to which he belonged. The Department of Labor issues an enforcement manual. They issue publications. They respond to opinion letters. And I've been in labor and employment lawyer for 20 years. I'm not aware of them ignoring a request for an opinion letter. So what we have here is there are mechanisms for them to rely on. There are times that regulations are found to be invalidated or to be found to go beyond the scope of the statute. If that was the case in this case where regulation was invalidated and they showed they relied on it, they would have a defense here because there's a good faith reason for it. But the fact that they relied on these three communications does not meet the high standard that was put in by this section. And if defendants want to go to the legislature and say it should be easier to invoke the good faith defense, that's their right to do that. And they can see whether they can get the legislature to pass that. But as it's written right now, it does not meet the standard. One other point that was raised that I wanted to address in terms of should these employees all be bound? There's nothing in the record based on these three documents to indicate what did Cremo Land represent to this investigator? What did they say to this hearing officer? Discovery wasn't complete on that issue. So under what defendants are proposing, misrepresentations could be made. There couldn't be a complete investigation, or there could be items that were left out. There could be an incomplete record on which these investigators and hearing officers made their determinations. We don't know that because there's no record that's been presented, certainly in the two emails, and not really in the handwritten notes. That's why that these – I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, finish your answer. Sorry.
That's why the legislature determined that the hearing officer and an investigator did not have the authority to allow an employer to invoke a good faith defense.
Can you amplify parts of your earlier answer? What is it that an employer can do to seek protection in a situation such as this, where you have three proceedings that have been completed and they've prevailed? What steps practically can an employer take in order to be able to invoke a good faith exception?
They can request an opinion letter from the Department of Labor to make sure that they're doing what they need to do. And they can make sure that they're in compliance with the statute. Right now, what we're doing is all we're saying is that we want to get discovery on this issue. We want to have a full record that we present to the court, and a judge can make a determination on whether or not it is or not. If they're right, that they are a trucking industry employer.
Counselor, you seem to be arguing on your summary judgment that there are facts that's needed to be developed. There are facts about the employee, but these letters were about the business itself. Those facts are not relevant to what the arguments you're making. This was about whether the employees in those letters complied. It was about the industry itself, whether it and proper overtime. So I don't see how the facts you're arguing that could have been developed about your particular client change anything in the letters, because they were not about, as I read them, and correct me if I'm wrong, they were not about whether those individuals were entitled to further overtime pay, but it was a determination as to what the industry was. So I don't see how the facts as to your client have any relevance to the argument here.
Well, I think the relevance is, and this is why these letters should not be used to invoke a good faith defense, is we were entitled to get discovery to find out whether or not, and it is about, it's not about my clients, it's about this industry. It's about this company. If this company is in retail, if this company is selling products that are out in the market, and if they're marketing for their product, which they're creating, under the appellate division case in Raymore Flanagan, I'd have a good argument that they are not a trucking industry employer. So that's something that I was entitled to pursue. So this is exactly the reason why we should be allowed to pursue it. If there was an incomplete record, in two of the three communications, there was no basis for it whatsoever.
Do you then concede that if your discovery reveals that they are what they represented to be in those three letters, then the letters are applicable?
If through your discovery,
you determine that the Cremo Land Dairy is exactly what they were represented they were in those three earlier letters, then is that the end of it? Do you concede that that's the end of your case, because then those letters apply?
I don't think the letters are sufficient. Whether or not Cremo Land is a trucking industry employer in this litigation should rise and fall on whether or not they meet the standard for being a trucking industry employer.
You responded to the chief's question with two options, and I want to ask you about both. I want to take the second one first. You said they should make sure they're in compliance with the statute. Well, isn't that a conclusory thing? Because this whole thing is about whether they're in compliance with the statute, right? Whether they in good faith believe they're in compliance with the statute. What meaning does that have outside of this process that's going on?
The meaning it has is that the informal nature of the communications should not be sufficient to invoke a good faith defense. If they want to defend themselves against this case, then they should be sure that they're on the right side of whether there's a violation or not.
Well, I think we can put that idea aside because it's essentially saying they should be in compliance with the statute, and that's it doesn't create a route to get there. So let's focus on your first answer, which is they could seek an opinion letter. Let's say they get an opinion letter signed by the section chief. They got it. What would be your position on an opinion letter signed by the section chief?
The statute says commissioner of the Department of Labor or the director of the Wage and Hour Bureau. So my position is that those are the two the position would have to come from them.
So you're saying if they ask, they go back to the three opinions, they go back, they say we want an opinion letter, and it comes in the mail or email, and it's signed by the section chief. That's not worth the paper it's written on when it comes to the good faith defense. Is that your position?
I refer Your Honor to the letter that was submitted belatedly by defendants, the opinion letter that they did not rely upon. That was signed by the director of the Division of Wage and Hour Compliance.
Okay.
Which is,
I get it. And you're arguing that for a number of other reasons, you say that we shouldn't consider that. But the point is that asking for an opinion letter is not enough. You're saying they've got to specifically say, commissioner or director, I need an opinion letter signed by you, period. Otherwise, it's not worth it to them.
If they want to seek an opinion letter to invoke the good faith defense in the future under the statute as it's written, when they write to the commissioner, what they should do is when they write to the commissioner of labor, they should say, we are seeking this for purposes of invoking the good faith defense going forward. And we would, as such, under the statute, this would need to be issued by the director of the wage and hour.
If it said section chief for the commissioner, because as we've heard from various of the attorneys here, the commissioner and the director work through many of the employees. They can't conceivably do everything on their own. If the letter said section chief for the commissioner, would that be sufficient?
Yes.
In your experience, what's the likelihood of getting a commissioner or the director to issue the opinion letter that you've talked about?
In my experience, when requests for opinion letters are made, that they're responded to.
By the commissioner or the director?
By the general. I don't see them by the commissioner. I've seen them by the director.
Have you seen them signed by others?
Have you seen opinion letters? And I don't know the answer to this. You've been in this, obviously, a tremendous amount of experience in it. Have you ever seen opinion letters from the department that are signed by employees who are not the commissioner or director?
Justice, I want to be very careful. In my experience, they're signed by the director. I can't represent to you that I've never seen one that was signed by a section that was signed by someone else.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Counsel, this is a class action case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
How many employees are seeking relief in this case?
The class size, Your Honor.
Size. Go ahead.
It'd be in the hundreds. And, Your Honor, the one thing that's important here is when these individuals come forward to file their complaints to the Department of Labor, they're given no notice. There's no representation to them that by filing this, oftentimes on their own without counsel, that they're potentially, you know, waiving the statutory rights of people who want to seek this, you know, seek relief under the statute, you know, over a decade later. I mean,
that's the reason why I'm asking you the question, because this class action has hundreds of, there could be other class action cases that involve thousands of people who are claiming that they'd suffered violations of the wage and hour law. And I guess one of the issues before the court is, to what degree can a business rely upon what you're describing as informal decisions of the of of the Office of Division of Labor, Department of Labor.
Well, what's especially problematic here is there may be instances where the nature of their business changes, or their management changes, or their marketing changes. These are all things that can happen where we're looking back to the first letter was signed in 2007, I believe. The other two were filed in 2014 and 16. These are just years before.
So we have one in 2017, presumably that's pretty. If you view this as informal, what does that mean? Assuming that if you had represented an employee and they had one before the hearing officer, the section chief, I doubt you'd be in any way denigrating that as anything other than pay up. That's the Department of Labor telling you that you have to pay this penalty.
When you say
informal, I think if it was giving relief to your client, you would not be suggesting it's anything other than a decision by the department that's absolutely enforceable.
Let me be specific and address the term informal. What I'm addressing here solely is what is allowed to be a basis for a good faith defense. When I'm using the term informal, so I'll retract that and say a lower level determination. So okay. You're correct, Your Honor. If I'm representing someone at the DOL, which I generally don't do, I'll go to litigation if I'm pursuing something, because you have broader rights to get discovery. You have more. It's a better venue. I would pursue that, but pursue it there. But I would seek to enforce any judgment that I had. But the fact is, if for purposes of this specific statute, these lower level determinations, which aren't final determinations, which aren't policy statements made by the commissioner or the director or the department, are not sufficient to invoke this good faith defense. Because what this good faith defense does is it strips the statutory rights away from workers. And that's a
so there's no, but you're not saying there's a distinction between formal and informal that is material here. You're talking about who is the employee who's issuing the decision. That's the only issue.
Who's the employee that's issuing the decision? Do they have the right? Are they among the people who are enumerated under the section of the statute to invoke this? And in terms of the use of informal, if you look at the nature of the communications that were issued here, and you contrast that with the opinion letter or any opinion letter you could take a look at, this is vastly different.
If the shoe were on the other proverbial foot and you won and the company said, oh, but that's just an email, you'd be all over that. I suggest with great skill saying this is an absolute determination by the Department of Labor that you owe this money. Doesn't matter if it came in an email.
Jess, I think we're comparing apples and oranges. Whether or not
I understand you're focused on the good faith defense, but to me, I think there's a distinction between saying the method of communication versus the person. As I see your argument, it's not about the method of communication, or it shouldn't be. It should be about who is the person signing it.
The reason I bring up the mode of communication is to, as a policy perspective, and as you're interpreting the statute, whether a hearing officer or an investigator should, because we're hearing a lot of policy arguments from the other side, whether it should rise to the level of providing a good faith defense is, and should it be read into the statute, which I'm saying it shouldn't, and the law has been clear that a statute should be read for its plain meaning and to create more opportunity for employees to be covered by the statute. I'm saying that would be a bad policy argument to pursue, and it would not be wise to read that into the statute because the nature of the communications are what I describe as informal, but the lower level, but you're absolutely correct. What I'm invoking as being inadequate to invoke the good faith defense under the statute is the fact that these people did not rise to the level of having were not high level enough in order to invoke the protections under the statute.
Counsel, in your representation of employees and these kinds of actions, if we were to adopt the interpretation that we're being asked to adopt by the defense, would that have the result of resulting in fewer settlements of employees' actions going before the Department of Labor? Will it have a long-term effect of actually hurting employees' abilities to get easy and quick relief through the Department of Labor?
Justice, thank you for that question. This is very dangerous, what defendants are asking us to do, because oftentimes, and people who file complaints with the Department of Labor don't go in with attorneys. They're not aware of what their full statutory rights are. They're not aware of what to pursue with discovery. They're not. It's an uneven playing field in many ways, and I understand that these hearing officers and investigators are doing their best, but they're not. The employers are often, as in this case, they're often represented by attorneys, and that's not really an equal playing field. And to the extent that you have, a situation here where they were represented by an attorney, there's no evidence that these individuals were. They didn't have the same opportunity to pursue discovery, to ask questions, to do what an attorney would do. And it was very dangerous because these three did not realize, there's nothing in the record to indicate that they realized that they'd be potentially binding people, you know, over a decade later I think this would have an extremely chilling effect on people wanting to go forward with the Department of Labor, because the consequences of a hearing, unless they wanted to pursue it the whole way, and they don't know that. And I represent a lot of workers like this, they're not aware of the intricacies of the appellate process and what's potentially binding on a company or on future employees. They don't know that. So that's going to obviously inform it's going to inform how vigorous they're going to be. And if people think, hey, I can be potentially hurting all my fellow workers, they're not going to go to the DOL.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Sadarajan?
Chief Justice, we said before, I on my form, I asked for a couple minutes on rebuttal. So I was going to ask for that. I put it on the
form. Sorry. Is there a cross petition?
No, it's fine, Your Honor. There's not a cross petition.
Rebuttal is only in such a circumstance. Thank you, counsel. Right. Ms. Jones. You have to unmute yourself, please.
Apologies. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The state accepted the appellate division's invitation to participate as amicus in this matter. In order to provide the court with the context in which the administrative dispositions relied on Cremoland occurred, and also to provide its opinion based on that context as to whether those decisions were sufficient to satisfy the wage and hour law's good faith defense. In labor's view, the administrative dispositions relied upon by Cremoland, even taken together, are not the type of administrative decisions or actions required to establish the good faith defense. As the appellate division recognized, there are a broad range of ways that the Department of Labor administers its statutory charge and communicates and interacts with the regulated public. But the good faith defense specifically recognizes only a small subset of those administrative actions that would be sufficient to establish such a defense. In this way, the legislature was striking a balance between providing a safe harbor for employers who rely on the agency's statement of law and not precluding potentially meritorious claims for wage and hour violations to go unexamined. And the legislature drew this line very carefully and specifically. It specifies only written rules, regulations, orders of the agency head or the director of the Bureau of Wage and Hour, or an administrative practice or enforcement policy of the department with respect to a class of employers. We've heard a lot of discussion here about lower level employees, subordinate officers, rank. The focus is on the lower level nature of these decisions, really is a comparison between what a commissioner level or a director level decision represents. It's an administrative action that speaks for the department as a whole, which speaks to the department's view of the law and how it should be applied, just as commissioner level or director level decisions would. We want a decision that bears the character of speaking for the department, that speaks to the policy of the department. It's an enforcement policy or administrative practice of the department or the bureau with respect to a class of employers. So not just an individual determination, but one to speak to the department's policy as a whole. That is what the legislature intended employers would be able to use to establish the good faith defense when they were striking this balance.
Ms. Jones, I have a question for you. What are the mechanisms? I'm sure I haven't used the proper terminology. What are the mechanisms for an employer to use if they have won at this level that we're talking about here, or analogous level, and they want a determination that will provide them, based on your interpretation, with the good faith defense? And the second part of my question is, does the department have the discretion to ignore that request and simply not provide that broad level policy determination that you have indicated the AG interprets the statute to require?
I'm happy to answer that question, Justice. The tools that employer, if they are seeking to have a good faith defense, they want to have something in writing that they can use to establish a defense, to a subsequent lawsuit, as in this case. They could seek an opinion letter. They could seek a ruling. They could seek a declaratory ruling that's provided for under the APA. Those are the things that an employer could ask for from the department. They could also choose not to settle or engage in an informal conference. There's no requirement on the regulations that an employer engage in an informal conference.
Right, but let me go back to that because I just want to see how this would work. Opinion letter, ruling, or declaratory ruling under the APA is what you indicated. Does that always come from the commissioner or the director? All three of those categories. And secondly, can the commissioner or director simply say, we're too busy with a flood of unemployment situations in 2020 to provide you with an opinion? Our hearing officer, our section chief, dealt with your problem. We're not going there right now. We've got too many other priorities.
The answer to your question is yes. Those would be discretionary on the part of the Department of Labor. They do not have to engage in that way.
Okay.
Can you tell us how often the discretion is invoked not to provide a response, not to provide a letter or a ruling?
I understand, Justice, your question. I'm not prepared to say how often that happens. Participating here just as amicus on the sort of narrow request made by the appellate division, we didn't endeavor to find out that question from the department, so I would have to consult with my client to really answer that.
Did I hear you say earlier that in order to protect us as an employer, rather than settling and resolving the matter when neither are sure, the proper way would be to ignore settlement and proceed to litigation or in order to obtain a letter from the commissioner? When you can resolve something simply and fairly for both sides, that's not the way to go, in your opinion. You should always go for trial or for a controversy so that you can get a determination letter. Is that what you said earlier? I just want to make sure I understood you.
That's not exactly what I said, but I understand, Justice, your point. It's not my opinion that employers should go that route. My point was more that an employer choosing to settle at these type of conferences is discretionary on the part of the employer. So it's not mandated that they go through this procedure and engage in the informal conference with the Department of Labor. I think that's important just to put into context the administrative practice that's involved with these letters, is that it is not final in many respects, and that even if the Department of Labor decided not to take an enforcement action, nothing would preclude the affected employee from filing their own civil suit or a wage collection proceeding.
You're not discouraging settlements. All you're
absolutely
suggesting
not.
From what I'm hearing is if there is a settlement at some very low level, it's not necessarily going to bind thousands of other similarly situated employees who may have had or suffered violations of the wage and hour law. That's what you're saying.
Correct.
So the only way to obtain a determination is to continue through in whatever case it is and try to make that precedential? Is that the only way you can obtain protection? to just proceed through to the end?
In terms of this administrative type of practice, it is our opinion that it would have to be a decision by the commissioner. But as we've stated before, and my colleagues here have expressed, there are other ways that an employer interacts with the Department of Labor that may be sufficient. A good example of that is the opinion letter that Cremo Land relied upon here. We were of the opinion that that would be sufficient as a good faith defense.
Ms. Jones, I just wanted to come back to the point about getting an opinion letter or getting a ruling. I'm not trying to pin you down here. Can you give us a sense? Are they routinely issued? Are they rarely issued? Is it something in between?
I apologize, Justice. I really can't give you a sense of that. I did not have the opportunity about that particular issue.
Can I ask the question in a slightly different way, Counsel? If this settlement resulted in revealing to the Department of Labor person who presided over the informal settlement that improper wages, improper overtime was being practiced at a particular employer, what is the obligation of the Department of Labor to pursue a remedy, notwithstanding the settlement of the individual claim?
If I understand, Justice, your question, typically those settlements involve not only some measure of penalty, but also back wages to the affected employees. So typically,
what about other employees?
I'm not sure the answer to that question, whether they sort of establish a class for that particular complaint. I'm not sure the answer to that question.
Well, is it fair to understand the way the structure of this Wage and Hour Bureau operates, that there is an enforcement obligation on the part of the Department of Labor? As I understood it, employees could make a claim, but also there is an independent obligation on the part of the Bureau to enforce proper wage compliance. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's stated fairly. Yes, Justice.
Okay, so I'll come back to my question. If an informal settlement reveals that an employer is acting contrary to the department's view on the proper calculation of overtime, what, if anything, do you believe the legal structure of this bureau requires of the department to follow up on its obligation?
I understand, Justice, your question. I'm really not prepared to answer that question
today. Do you agree that there have been independent penalty actions that have been pursued on complaint by the Department of Labor? Because I seem to recall such actions being filed in the Office of Administrative Law.
They do. It's an employer, you know, contesting a penalty or they're contesting a finding. Certainly, that matter is transmitted to the Office of Administrative Law, goes for a full plenary hearing with a final decision by the commissioner in that instance. So that does occur. That occurs frequently.
Okay. So there is a mechanism, I guess, if a violation of an industry requirement was revealed through an informal settlement, other than the employer requesting an opinion letter, a ruling, or a declaratory ruling, there is a collateral obligation of sorts on the department to vindicate the violation.
I would think that the department does, if they are aware of violation of the wage and hour statutes, that they would take enforcement action. It's not always generated by an employee complaint. Sometimes the Department of Labor, on their own initiative, will bring enforcement actions against employers. So it's both sides. It's not just if they happen to get a complaint, they'll follow up on it. They do have broad enforcement powers to, on their own initiative, to do that.
But and some actions are brought by unions, sorry. Are they not?
Yes, and it's true. Sometimes unions do communicate with the Department of Labor that say we're aware of a particular practice, and that does generate an enforcement action on the Department of Labor. That is true. There's no requirement that the complaint come specifically from an employee. okay. to generate
you've
that
been enforcement. You've been exploring with Justice LaVecchia the situation where the through the process, the department determines that there's been improper overtime, for example, and that's the premise of your discussion with Justice LaVecchia. None of that applies if the department sees no problem, correct?
Correct.
So these mechanisms and the sort of natural process that one would expect to occur, including enforcement actions, including unions getting involved, including the bubbling up of an employee's action to the point where they are their position is vindicated, none of that would apply to the employer that's actually complying with the law, correct?
Right, and I think, Justice, you're recognizing here, you know, the tension in the law, but I don't think that's what was unintended by the legislature. I think that the legislature, our opinion is the legislature intended it to be a difficult bar to meet because of the collateral consequences. We're talking about a complete bar to liability, even if that decision or opinion or ruling or regulation that they're relying on is found to be invalid. So that's a very high standard, and what an employer should be relying on should be concomitant with the force of that good faith defense if applied appropriately.
But just to sum up, I'm not talking about the merits of this case. Assume that the employer is complying with the law. That employer cannot get the defense, has no mechanism of getting with certainty the determination that would allow them to assert the good faith defense. That compliant employer, if the department simply decides for what may be very valid resource reasons or whatever, that it's not going to respond to a request. Am I right about that?
You're right, Justice, and that would be the same position as any employer who never had a complaint issued against them, that when under the department's radar.
And maybe because they're compliant. Right, exactly.
That's right.
But there's no certainty. There's a certainty if they're found to be in violation, but when they are found not to be in violation at that level, these various levels in DOL, they can't get what they need for the good faith defense, for sure.
No, unless they used any of the other means that we've talked about that to get
but
some
they're
sort
not
of opinion.
They can ask, but they're not guaranteed that response. Am I right about that?
You're correct, Justice.
Thank you.
Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Jones? We're a little over 5 minutes at this point.
My fault, Chief.
Being mindful of my time, I certainly don't want to go beyond the 5 minutes. I think based on Justice's, your questions here today, that pretty sums up my
Thank
plan
you.
Statement.
Thank you. Mr. Galperin.
Yes, may I please support Michael Galperin, Associate. Troubled by Cremoland's position in this case that essentially what they're trying to do is have summary judgment granted and reinstated after the appellate division reversed it with an inadequate record. And we've heard reference to the three DOL employees and informal communications. And keeping in mind that the first communication was July 27, 2007, 13 years ago. Cremoland wants this court to believe without an appropriate record that it was unable to comply with the literal language of the statute and get a communication or an opinion letter or an advisory opinion from the commissioner or from the department head without adequate proofs before this court. The appellate division clearly said that was inappropriate. On this record before this court, with inadequate discovery, with discovery still not being completed on critical issues, according to plaintiffs, according to the appellate division, Cremoland should not be entitled to a summary judgment. Cremoland wants this court to rewrite the critical language of the statute, the plain language of the statute, Section 2, where it clearly said you need the commissioner or you need the bureau chief to issue an opinion letter. They want you to do away with that under an assertion that would be difficult to obtain without an appropriate record, with a completely inappropriate record, and go forward and for time immemorial for other employers to be able to claim the good faith defense without a proper communication from the commissioner or from the department head. And the first tenet of legislative interpretation is if the language is clear in the statute, interpret it clearly. This language could be clearer. We know from the second section that the legislator intended to allow the department head and the commissioner to use its delegates to make communications. And the reference to Ms. Jones being part of a large attorney general's office, and it would be silly to expect the attorney general not to delegate things through his employees. That is an inopposite argument. It doesn't apply in this circumstance. Remember what we have. We have an informal handwritten letter written here, Mark, who happens to be counsel of the record and has his own, assumingly, issues as inserting himself as a witness. That is not the type of formal communication that legislature intended or that the federal courts interpreting a similar statute would permit as the fodder for a good faith defense. And that is why, respectfully, even though this statute was written many, many, many years ago, the legislature intended by very quick words to require the commissioner or require the department head to make a formal answer.
Mr. Galpin, can I ask you one question?
Yes.
I reading the statute, I see the plain language you're relying upon, an interpretation or approval by the commissioner of the department or the director of wage and hour. And then it says, or any administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department or bureau. It doesn't say of the commissioner or of the director with respect to the class of employers.
Yes.
Or seems to set it off, that it's not just the approval by the commissioner or the director, but a practice. In this case, we don't have a 2007, or we have that too, a 2007, 13 year ago handwritten note. We have two other findings, most recently, I guess, in 2017. Is there a point in time when, even though the commissioner or director's name's not on it, that those repeated findings become an administrative practice or enforcement policy of the department?
Well, we keep referring to them as a finding, but remember, one of these quote-unquote findings was made in the course of a settlement negotiation where earlier a $40,000
penalty. Understood. What I'm asking is, we have three of them. We have three letters or emails or whatever they are, just three instances where certain things were, there were certain conclusions made that they were a trucking employer. Right or wrong, depth of investigation, I don't know. But I'm just saying, is there a point in time in this case or any case in which these acts become an administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department, even though the commissioner or the director's name doesn't appear on it?
Well, I think that the second section of the good faith defense statute requires administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department with respect to the class of employers to which he belongs. And I don't believe that either of these three informal communications from low or mid-level employees or mid-level employees suffices under this statute, especially, and we can't lose sight of this, and the appellate division focused laser sharp on this, especially on an inadequate discovery record.
Let me ask you what you mean by that. Does that mean, to use the funeral home example from the one case dealing with this, that the class of, there has to be a ruling on all funeral homes in New Jersey,
I don't think we have to take that extreme, but certainly at a bare minimum, we need to know, and nobody on this Zoom conference knows, what discovery and what facts and what investigative materials went into those.
Understand, and I appreciate you, and you've made the point regarding process in this case. But what I'm saying is, are you suggesting that in order to meet that second prong, which seems to be an alternative prong, there must be a ruling from the department about a class of employers, not just about this individual employer?
Well, I don't want to answer, I'm not ducking the question, but I don't want to say absolutely yes or absolutely no, because if we say absolutely no, we give no deference to the Attorney General's position in this case. If we say
I'm not trying to pin you down. I just thought you were saying that it requires something broader than a ruling about a particular employer. If that's not what you meant to say, then I don't need an answer to the question.
Certainly, Justice Patterson. And I don't think I said that. What I think I said, and certainly what I intended to say, is that under the facts of this case, on this very meek record, we haven't given either the trial court or the parties the adequate opportunity to establish what went into the making of these three pieces of paper by any interpretation of legislation.
Would you ever get discovery? Can you get discovery? You can get discovery, I'm sure, of the defendant. If, and I'm not saying you're here as amicus, but in a lawyer representing employees, a class of employees. But could the lawyer representing class of employees ever demand that the agency provide the decision makers and sit them down in a conference room or virtually and ask them questions about what went into their decision?
Hopefully we get back to real live depositions.
Hopefully we will. Yes, sir.
It's not your question. And the answer is, short of taking an employee's deposition, there's certainly a paper trail and a written record of what that person examined before issuing his or her opinion. Absolutely, there's some kind of written record as to what was before that particular hearing officer or that particular investigator. I mean, that's why we have investigative logs. Term what was going in, and there have been instances, I have been part of them, where investigators for the Attorney General's Office and Department of Labor and various state employees have been compelled to give depositions. Now, I want to focus on
counsel.
Mr. Gupp, go ahead, Justice.
So, counsel, just to kind of follow up on Justice Solomon's question, if these three communications were fuller and had more information with regard to the information that was before these hearing officers and investigators prior to making their determination, if those communications were not just these short emails and that were sent, would you think that this would be a practice of the department such that the employer could rely on these?
Well, I guess I would quote the great legal scholar Yogi Berra when he says, "I never make decisions, especially about the future." The point is, we don't know. We don't know what went into making the sausage, and that's so critically important. We don't know what went into these determinations or how these determinations were reached.
Once you know, would they be, if the sausage, you know, all the ingredients of the sausage, would then they be appropriate under the or section, the second section, once you knew what making the sausage?
I don't think so, unless it's established that that was a communication on behalf of the agency.
Doesn't that nullify section 2 completely? Because section 1 says, doesn't that nullify section 2 completely under your interpretation? Because section 1 says commissioner or director. The second one says or. So you're saying even under the second section, it has to be something from the commissioner. So there'd be no need for a second part.
What I'm saying is that on the second section, it has to be an administrative practice or enforcement policy. Administrative practice or enforcement policy. Is one letter issued in a settlement proceeding based on one fact, is that an enforcement practice?
Put aside the facts of this case. As a friend of the court, tell us what you understand that means. What's required in order for the second category to be in play?
Something more than this. Something as a communication from the Department of Labor or the division, the wage and hour bureau chief, which says in this situation, we don't have to have a trial. We don't have to have the rights of the putative class examined. It is so clear that the employer gets the.
Why would the? I'm sorry, Mr. Galpin. Why would the agency say? Get into the merits of a case pending in court and say you don't have to have a trial. I mean, that would be a very bizarre thing for the agency to do, wouldn't it? This is so clear if you have a class action out there, that should be dismissed.
Well, the agency
wouldn't do that, would they? They make a determination on the issue of whether they're in or out of the overtime requirements.
I was responding to the justice's question, I guess, euphemistically, because that is the import of the good faith defense. We have to make a very important distinction between were these three letters simply a brief communication, as they certainly appear to be, from hearing officers and investigators, or were they, quote, an administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department or bureau? And I think the importance of that distinction, which Greenland and its amici for defense have glossed over, is highlighted by the New Jersey Civil Justice amici rhetorical example about Ms. Jones. If Ms. Jones were to send an email to another attorney or to another litigant, and it's not a formal appellate brief, a case can certainly be argued. A case can certainly be argued that informal communication, especially a handwritten communication like we have here, is not a practice or policy of the Attorney General. But a formal.
Mr. Galpin, it sounds like what you're describing, a practice or policy, is established by an opinion letter. And therefore, part one and part two are the same. It's something that sounds exactly like what you've described is necessary.
A practice or policy, in my view, certainly can be satisfied by an opinion letter, but doesn't always have to be an opinion letter.
How, other than an opinion letter, which sounds like, I don't mean to prolong this, but it sounds like what you were just describing is you could get something from the director or the commissioner, and it would say, that's an opinion letter. Give me another example of how to satisfy part two of the statute without an opinion letter.
Well, I would imagine under the Administrative Procedures Act, a certain high-ranking ruling on a full record could be sufficient.
Never going to have when the employer wins.
Sorry?
Never. You're never going to have that when the employer wins. Why is he going to pursue it?
Well, in this case, and counsel seemed to imply that it would have been so hard to get an opinion letter. In this case, if you have three informal rulings from the mid-level employee Department of Labor, I don't think it would have been difficult at all to get.
Listen, I'm not arguing that point.
Right.
You were talking about part two of the statute, which Justice Fernandez-Vina said sounds like it's superfluous, and you're essentially admitting it's superfluous because part one requires that opinion letter or a final ruling in a contested case. Part two requires an opinion letter or a final ruling in a contested case. I'm not disputing that's maybe correct, but that sounds like what you're saying, and I'm not going to belabor this anymore. That's my last comment.
I'm certainly not suggesting that the second part is superfluous, but what I am suggesting is that these three very, very, very informal communications, one of which was handwritten, one of which was issued in a settlement proceeding, without
why is handwriting important to you? It was handwritten and signed. If I send you a letter of handwriting, you can ignore it?
No, I certainly wouldn't ignore it, especially from on it, but no. I do think a handwritten letter, and I think the appellate division thought the same, as well as the attorney general, that a handwritten note does not have the decorum and the formalcy of.
Mr. Galpern, take these three informal settlements resolutions and multiply it so we have 50 of them over the course of, let's say, 3 years. There are 50. Would that make a difference? Would the sheer number of actions, even at a lower level, constitute an administrative practice?
It very well might, Your Honor. I think that's the inverse of the question that was asked of counsel for COL, and that is, if there was just one letter, would it have mattered? Do numbers matter? Yeah, they matter, but they matter in the context of the entire phenomenon and the whole scenario. And I don't mean to repeat myself, but we don't have a whole scenario. We never got a whole scenario.
Let me ask you to try to bring your argument to a close in view of the hour.
We had an entire class action eliminated on a meager and incomplete record, and on that basis alone, the appellate division's determination should be confirmed. I thank you for your time. I also want to welcome Justice Pierre Louis to the Supreme Court, and thank you once again for allowing me to appear.
Thank you. Mr. Cott, rebuttal?
Yes. On the statement that discovery was incomplete, I think we need to go back to basics. The three administrative findings concluded that we were a trucking industry employer. Under the last sentence of the statute, we are entitled to that finding, even if it was legally incorrect. Therefore, the plaintiffs do not get to relitigate whether we're a trucking industry employer, because, and we are, it's clear, but assuming we're not, we would still have the benefit of the good faith defense. As to what the three employees took into account, that's covered again by the statement of uncontroverted facts, again referring to 108 to 110A, where the plaintiff in this case admitted that the first and third were full field investigations. What that means is the Department of Labor actually went out and inspected the premises, talked to employees, and those kinds of things. With respect to Justice Albin's question about this being a class action, yeah, that's what supports us. Class action is enormous exposure for a defendant. And it's particularly difficult for a smaller company. And that's the reason why application of the good faith defense in this case is so important. Finally, and related to the prejudice to our people, my client, if the court adopts the interpretation of the Attorney General, first time stated in this litigation as an amicus, a complete surprise to Criminaland, which relied on the three rulings. In this case, any ruling contrary to on this legal issue should be prospective only, because otherwise, Criminaland is being treated to great prejudice by a first-time opinion of the Attorney General. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you. Thank you to all.